So welcome to lecture 22, November 6, 2023, lecture notes, page 191. Regardless of where you sit on the political spectrum, whether you're for or against issue one, for or against issue two, Republican, Democrat, or independent, vote tomorrow if you're eligible, because it's your right, duty, and privilege as an American citizen. Vote. Research extra credit number one. Email came out to you last Wednesday. Participate in the survey before this Friday at whatever time he said, and earn 0.5% of your final course grade. I can't post the grades until he gets back to me. He has to look at everybody, see if they really participated properly or not. So it'll likely be a week from Wednesday before I hear back from him. I'll post grades then. So here we are. As you know, midterm two is up, running, and runs through the end of the week. Closing on Saturday at 6 p.m. It should be as you expect it to be. Midterm two is, let's say two or one? Two. Midterm two is open, running. And because we keep a steady schedule, mini test 11 will also open tomorrow and its regular schedule. And of course, it's not Saturday the 12th. You look at these things over and over, you think you got them right, and they're still wrong. It closes on Sunday the 12th on its regular schedule. I'll correct that later. Enhancing extra credit number eight is up and running, and it'll close on Wednesday. Those who participated on average have added 1.8%. I thought it was higher than that. To their final course grade, good job. So, any questions on midterm two exam? Yes, sir. So, I sent it in another posting on the website on Canvas. So it's a lecture 11 to 20, mini test 6 to 10, and I gave that additional detail in a note I sent. So go to the announcements, and it'll recap that specific. If it doesn't, let me know, but it's pretty specific, and it does match up with that stuff. Other questions for me? Okay, so this is all the standard stuff we've seen before. Business in the news. Climate activists wants the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, to copy California and Europe legislation, laws. So this goes to the thing we see periodically, the United Nations Sustainability Goals for Sustainable Development. Goal number 12, responsible consumption and production. Climate activists are urging U.S. regulators to follow the footsteps of the European Union and California as they work to finish requirements for public companies to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions. So this is the impact of regulatory, legal, and political factors on business. It's also a part of sustainable business. I digress to say, this is out of the Wall Street Journal, I looked at the comments from people who read the Wall Street Journal. Unanimously negative. No one who posted a comment like this. It's all baloney. It's greenhouse gases. Why do we care? It's going to be more costly. Who's going to be able to figure that out? Different political views are shared by our classmates, by business people. This was unanimously against this post. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed legislation earlier this month that will oblige large companies doing business in the state to report both their carbon emissions and those of their suppliers and customers. That's where a lot of the posters got really unhappy. How am I going to know what my customers are doing with their emissions? How am I going to know that? Because so many U.S. companies will be subject to the California law, because so many companies do business there, similarly extensive SEC rules wouldn't add much to their costs, according to the activist groups. So again, UN Sustainable Development Goal 12, responsible consumption and production. The SEC has said its goal is to make emissions estimates, which some companies are already compiling voluntarily, more consistent and comparable to one another so investors can use them more reliably. So we'll see what happens on this external factor as it impacts business. There are all kinds of segments out there. I've commented before that I like to shop at Kohl's and my wife likes to shop at Nordstrom. Okay. This is a whole other segment. And when I get to the pricing here, if you haven't already seen it, the question in your mind would be, if you had a kid, most of you don't, how much would you spend for a 100-milliliter bottle of lotion for the kid? 100 milliliters is about 3.5 ounces. How much would you spend on your kid? Now, it's your kid, I understand. But it's a bottle of lotion. How much would you spend, on, if you haven't already seen it, on a bottle of lotion for a kid? Just off the top of your head, I know you don't know. How much might you spend? $12? $5, you have a shot coming. $12, any other? Yeah. Like how much? $10 to $12 for a 3.5 ounce. You can use it over and over, and, you know, makes the kid feel good and smell good. Hang on to those thoughts, because we're in a different market segment than you or I inhabit. Dior, baby scent, and bath line are sent to relaunch. Dior announces the revival of baby Dior's scent and bath line called the Bon Nettoir Collection as a timeless ode to the purity and sweetness of childhood. Born in 1970, the Baby Dior fragrance line is now relaunching and offering a scent that exudes tenderness inspired by Bon Nettoir, Lucky Star. So this is product life cycle, I guess, relaunching a brand that, you know, matured and they ended it. And it's also a bit about the target market you're aiming this at. The fragrance is alcohol-free, formulated with 98% natural origin ingredients, suitable for babies and children. It includes notes of green pear, wild rose, and white musk, just as you want for your kid. So there are product features. The bottle of Bon Nettoir Eau de Ceinture, scented water, is available in two shades, light pink and light mint green for the bottle. The pastel-colored bottles feature an imaginative garden of Granville adorned with a menagerie of colorful hot air balloons. You can customize the bottle by adding the colored ribbon of your choice, just like your child's lucky star. So a bit about packaging in the product mix. We talked about packaging. Rounding out the line are bath products La Mousse Très Fondant, cleansing foam, and Le Très Tendre body lotion, and L'Eau Très liquid cleanser, each scented with Bon Nettoir and including Anjou Mellow Extract, a moisturizing ingredients grown in the Dior garden. So there's a product line. Product prices range from $95 for the 350 milliliter body lotion. This is for your kid. To $115 for 11.8 ounces of the Baby Dior Le Lait Très Tendre hydrating milk. To $230 for the 100 milliliter Baby Dior Bon Nettoir scented water. What? So here's price in the marketing mix. It is, of course, is the product line pricing. And as I like to say, I don't make this stuff up. Who could make it up? So here we are on their webpage. There's the $230 Baby Dior Bon Nettoir, $150 for this one. $95 for these things. I love my wife, but I'm glad she never came home with a $235 bottle of baby lotion for my kids. Different market segment, different life, not me. So, and again, we see how they have different products in their line and they're pricing them differently. I bring this up, of course, because we're talking about price in the marketing mix, right? Also, a part of price, we were talking about the profit margin, we were talking about cost. One of your costs is your cost to market. If you're a business selling advertising, that's your product. So this works out neatly on both sides. So businesses selling product have a price, selling commercials have a price. You're buying it to advertise your product as part of your cost, and you have to consider your price. What primetime TV ads cost this fall? The cost to advertise on primetime TV has declined for nearly all fall broadcast programming. Numerous factors converged on this year's upfront market to cause softer pricing than in years past, namely the Hollywood strikes, economic volatility, and declines in the number of people watching linear TV. So this has to do with the cost of marketing, because you're advertising on these shows as part of your cost, and it's the impact of external factors on business the shows trying to advertise are being adversely affected by these factors. Of the 25 fall shows across NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, the CW, and Amazon Prime Video, returning from last year's TV pricing chart, 23 showed declines in the unit price for a 30-second commercial. Only two programs increased pricing, Fox's WWE Friday Night SmackDown. We just talked a little bit ago about WWE being the major thing on MTV. It's still around, just on a different network. And NBC's Sunday Night Football. So these are, again, marketing costs if you're buying products, those ads. At the top of the list, the most expensive shows in primetime is NBC's Sunday Night Football at an average cost of $882,079 per 30-second commercial. Sunday Night Football has grown pricing nearly 6.5% compared to what it was in 2022. Back then it was $828,000 per unit. You got to sell a lot of product to cover that 30-second ad, yeah? And of course, no one runs one 30-second ad for the season. You're running a bunch of them. Number two on the list, Monday Night Football on ABC, which costs advertisers $562,524 on average for 30 seconds. CBS's long-running news program, 60 Minute, joins the top 10 for the first time at $117,939, down 12% from last year's price. This year's primetime lineup includes a number of reruns. Why? Well, due to the Hollywood strikes, no shows were coming out. Naturally, it costs less to air a commercial in reruns than first-run episodes. For example, the cost to run a 30-second commercial during a rerun of Young Sheldon. Young Sheldon fans? Couple? A mere $50,521. Of the reruns airing during the fall primetime, Yellowstone is priced the highest, with reruns on CBS costing advertisers $78,000 for 30 seconds. Finally, Fox saw the biggest decline of any program with Lego Masters. Anybody watch Lego Masters? Oh, well, there you go. Apparently not a hugely popular show. Dropped 60% from $80,785 in 2022 to a mere $31,940 in 2023. Now, all of this, you have to take a little bit of grain of salt. These are what are called the advanced prices at the beginning of the season. They change over time, and nobody buys a single 30-second ad. So you negotiate a deal for a package of ads, right? But this would be the single unit pricing. All right, so we're looking at price both from the viewpoint of, hey, I'm selling product, ads, and I'm buying it as part of my marketing costs. On to lecture notes, page 191, chapter 13, page 367 in the textbook, and we were talking about factors to consider as you're doing your pricing. And one of the things we have to consider is the environment in which we operate. And we talked about the various competitive markets that are out there, and they would influence our price. This then recaps, we just happened to end at an odd time last time, recaps what we're talking about, the influence of the market you operate in, type of market you operate in, on the extent of price competition, the extent of product differentiation, the extent of advertising. So in pure competition, wheat, rye, barley, corn, things we've talked about over and over again, and you forget every time I ask you. Pure competition, many sellers who follow the market price for identical commodity products. How much price competition is there? Almost none. It's set by the market, the demand for the product. The extent of product differentiation, none. It's commodity. That's why it's a monopoly situation. They're all the same. Extent of advertising, very little advertising here. Why? The purpose is to inform prospects that your products are available, but there's no differentiation. Corn, corn, corn. Monopolistic competition. Many sellers who compete on non-price factors, toothpaste, toilet paper, there's some price competition over a bounded range of prices. There's some differentiation of the products, so we can use that to advertise, so there's a lot of advertising. Our purpose is to differentiate our products from the competitors on these things that are different from the competition. Oligopoly, a few sellers who are sensitive to one another's prices, we watch to see what they're doing. So there's some price competition, but we pay attention to the price leader out there and see what's going on periodically. Maybe not in recent years, but periodically the airlines, which are sort of an oligopoly, a relatively small number of sellers out there. Some airline would raise its prices from New York to LA, and then they would look around and no competition was following them, and then they would back down their prices from LA, New York to LA. You pay attention, see what everybody is doing, and then the market balances itself out. Extent of product differentiation, it depends on the industry, and the extent of the advertising. There's some, the purpose is to inform people about your product, but we want to avoid competition with these other large sellers. Pure monopoly, one seller who sets the price for a unique product. No price competition, they're the only people offering it. No product differentiation because, well, nobody else is producing water. The extent of advertising, little. The purpose is to increase demand for the product class or sometimes demarketing. Building a new power plant, building a new water plant or sewer plant is expensive. Stop using so much. So sometimes we actually see advertising to demarket. So now we're going to think step two is the process for us in setting our price. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about estimating demand and revenue. So step two in the process. And to think about this, we have to think about the demand curve. And you all remember this from your micro class, I'm sure. So this is just recap. You remember all the details. The demand curve is a graph showing the relationship between the price of a product and the quantity that would be sold at that price. It's going to show you the maximum number of units that we sold at a given price across the industry. Or maybe you're doing it just for your company, if you can work out a demand curve just for your company. Demand curves are often used to estimate product sales in competitive markets. It's influenced by a variety of things. For example, consumer tastes. Our example from the days of talking about fads, what were consumer tastes for Beanie Babies 30 years ago? Bam! Get me some! I can't have enough! Where's it today? Nah, I don't care. Taste shift, demand curve shifts. Price and availability of similar products. Here the idea is always the comparison between butter and margarine. They are substitutable in many people's minds. So if the price for butter goes up too much, what can you do? Well, you can shift over to margarine. So price of one goes up, you make a shift. And consumer income. If consumers have more money, they arguably will be willing to pay more for a good. So when you were earning 15 bucks an hour, Starbucks coffee looked expensive. Now you're earning 30 bucks an hour, nah, give me two of those things. So the income change affects the demand as well. Demand factors are factors that determine the customer's willingness and ability to pay for goods and services. So we're thinking about these things as we're thinking about setting our price. So let's look at the demand curve for Red Baron Pizza, showing the effects on annual sales of a change in price caused by movement along that demand curve. So the D1 curve doesn't move. It's downward pointing to the right, as demand curves usually are. And what do we see? We see that if we're going to charge $8 a pizza, we truck along to our demand curve. And how much will we sell according to our chart? We'll sell about 2 million pizzas. In our world, logically, what should happen if we drop our price? What should happen to the quantity that we sell? In general, what happens to it? In general, thank you. You do remember your micro? It does, as well as your logic. So in general, if we go down in price, we're going down from $8 to $6 a pizza, we can see what happens at Q2. The estimate is we'll move up to 3 million units sold. Yeah? So that's the basic idea of what happens when you move along an existing demand curve, nothing shifts in the demand curve, and you change your price. However, some factor may change the demand curve itself. As you can see, a factor has caused the demand curve to shift to the right. What could do that? Well, suddenly, on average, people earn a lot more money. So they're willing to spend more money on stuff. So in our example, under the old situation, demand curve one, at $8 a pizza, we sold 2 million pizzas, right? But suddenly everybody's feeling pretty wealthy. The demand curve shifts itself. And now at $8 a pizza, we're selling 4 million pizzas. what's going on in your marketplace with your consumers. What's happening to the average income? Is it shifting to the right? Is it shifting to the left? It's going to impact how much you can expect to sell. As part of estimating demand and revenue, we're going to think about the revenue side of the house. So total revenue. Total revenue is the total money that you get from the sale of your products. Shouldn't be a big surprise. What is that equal to? Oh, well, I see we need to use another term, and then we'll get to what it's equal to. Average revenue is the average amount of money received for selling one unit of the product. Why we can't just call it price, I don't know, but average revenue is the price per unit for our purposes. Accountants or economists may have a different view. So average revenue is the amount of money you get for selling one unit of the product. Marginal revenue is the change in total revenue that results from producing and marketing one more unit. Where we're going to head here, and you may remember from micro, I don't know, is something that the naive student, the naive consumer, the naive thinker doesn't realize. You would say, well, wait a minute. Don't I always do better by producing and marketing one more unit? Isn't that always going to work out in my favor? And the answer is, since I'm bringing it up, the answer is no. No, the marginal revenue begins to decline over a series of situations. Thank you. So let's see how we get there. Total revenue is the total amount of money received from the sale of a product. So logically, if total revenue, if TR equals total revenue, P equals price, and Q equals quantity sold, then total revenue is the price of the product times the quantity you sell. Hope we know that. Average revenue is the total revenue Two. Are we back? Thank you. So I don't know where we cut out. Total TR is equal to total revenue, price equals P equals price, quantity is Q, then total revenue is P times Q, and average revenue is TR divided by Q is equal to price. Fine and good. So what are we seeing here? Marginal revenue is the change in the total revenue that results from producing and selling one additional unit of a product. So marginal revenue is the change in the total revenue divided by a one unit increase in Q, in quantity sold, and that's the slope of the total revenue curve. The curve goes up, the curve goes down. Marginal revenue crosses the axis here. Let's see what this means in our pizza example and why we can't just keep producing and selling more and more units. All right? So let's see how Red Baron's downward sloping demand curve affects total average and marginal revenues. So we're going to start at $10 for a pizza. At $10, we're selling a million pizzas. Our total revenue is 10 times a million, $10 million. And our average revenue, our price is $10, all right? Let's move down from 10 bucks to 9 bucks. According to our logic, what should happen to our quantity sold? Well, it should go up, right? So now we're selling 1,500,000 pizzas. Total revenue goes up. We're selling 1.5, we're going to sell $13.5 million worth of pizza. Our average revenue is the same as the price, it's 9 bucks. And our marginal revenue, dividing the total revenue by the quantity, is $6, okay? So far, so good. We're happy. We've decreased our price, increased our production, and our revenue goes up. Let's try it here again. We're going to go from 8 bucks to 7 bucks. Quantity goes up again, 2 million to 2.5. Total revenue goes up, 16 million to 17.5. Average revenue, 7 bucks, and marginal revenue, 2 bucks. Wait a second, what's about to happen though? Suddenly things don't go the way we expected to. We go from 6 bucks to 5 bucks on our price. Quantity does go up as expected. It goes up to 3.5 million. But when you multiply the lowered price times the new quantity, what happens to your total revenue? It actually drops down. Producing and marketing one additional unit is beginning to cost you money. How much of that do you want to do? Not very much. So total revenues do not simply continue to grow higher and higher with each additional unit that we create. Our marginal revenues drop off, our total revenues drop off, and we're losing money once we cross that threshold for each unit we produce and sell. Do you imagine all marketers realize that? Not all of them. Do you imagine some are producing too much at too low a price and losing money? I promise you some are. So it's fairly important as a marketer, as you're setting your price, to at least be aware of the concept and ask yourself, how are we doing there? Price elasticity demand, again back to micro, which perhaps you remember, is the percentage change in quantity demanded relative to a percentage change in price. So if we drop our revenue by 10%, do our sales go up by 10%, more than 10%, less than 10%, that'd be something for us to know too. So price elasticity of demand is calculated as the percentage change in quantity demanded by the percentage change in price. So elastic demand, when a 1% change in price results in a greater than 1% change in sales, so elasticity, price elasticity demand is greater than 1. Let's mull that over for a second. 1% change in price results in a greater than 1% change in sales. So for me as a marketer, is that good or bad? Well, if I drop my price by 1%, what should happen to my sales then? What should they change by? No, that would be unitary. That would not be price elastic, not just 1%. It should change by? By more than 1%. I drop my price by 1%. My demand goes up by more than 1%. Hey, that might be a good deal for me. What happens if I raise my price by 1%? Presumably my sales would drop by more than 1%. So a slight decrease in price results, depending on how far over this number one we are, a small decrease in price results in a big change in demand. Drop my price a little bit when I have elastic demand. Boom, look what happens to my demand for my product. That'd be worth knowing. Also be worth knowing if I'm planning to raise my price too. All right, inelastic demand happens when a 1% change in price results in less than a 1% change in sales. So E is less than 1. What's this mean for me as a marketer? Doesn't seem too good if I lower my price. I'm not going to get a lot of extra sales. That didn't seem like a great idea. What happens if I have to raise my price? Well, then I'm going to have not such a big drop in my demand. That would be good if I have to raise my price. So a slight decrease in price results in a small, teeny increase in sales. And so here we are. If you're working on that hypothesis, lowering price to trade off for demand, in an inelastic market, your total sales revenue will actually decrease. Decrease. So it's not just philosophical, it's pragmatic. What is the demand elasticity for your product category in your industry? The reverse is also true. When demand is inelastic, a price increase results in a relatively small drop in sales. That could be okay for us. The demand for cigarettes is, unfortunately, relatively inelastic. That means when we increase the price for cigarettes by 7%, what happens to the demand? Well, it may drop a little bit, but it drops less than 7%, yeah? Inelastic demand. Now, it's a special product category. Why does not the demand for cigarettes drop? Why is it inelastic? Nicotine is addictive. It's very hard just to say, oh, I don't. If I were to increase the price of my kumquat flavored ding dongs, you might say, eh, I don't need any more of those. I'm done with those. You raise the price of cigarettes, a whole bunch of people are addicted to it. They can't just drop it. So it's a special case. So here a price increase of 10% only results in a drop in demand of 4% for cigarettes. Unitary demand. The percentage change in price is the same, identical to the percentage change in quality. There's nothing special about this. It's just a dividing line between elastic and inelastic. So price increase of 10%, demand change of 10%. Nothing special. Now, what influences the price elasticity of demand for products? Well, one is, are there product substitutes out there? Who's been to a movie theater recently? What are you paying for a ticket? $10? $10.35? Yeah. $10.45? $10 a pop. So it's, you know, you, a date, some popcorn and whatever. Man, you're in for big time bucks. What can substitute for going to a movie theater? Streaming, download. You know, you can watch Taylor Swift eventually on the stream. So movie theaters have to be aware of this problem that, hey, people can do something instead of going to a movie theater. Second of all, is your product that we're talking about considered to be a necessity or a luxury? If the product is a necessity, what happens when the price goes up? What happens to demand? It's a necessity. Does demand go up, down, or stay the same? Well, at least the same, right? It's not going to, if it drops, it's not by very much. You need it. You have to have it. So even when the price goes up, it's going to be inelastic. Now, part of the question is, who's your target audience? For me, the Four Seasons Hotel is not a necessity. Motel 8 would be okay. For others, it may be possible that in your segment, they consider the Four Seasons Hotel or something equivalent to necessity. So is it considered a necessity or luxury by your target audience? And finally, is it a large cash outlay relative to your income? If it's a big cash outlay, you're likely to be more elastic. So, which product is more sensitive to price changes? In other words, which is more of a necessity, gasoline or fashion? Gasoline is more of a necessity. So gas prices go up, people still need it. Demand does not drop down as quickly. Fashion prices go up, people are stressed. Sorry, fashion people. People buy less of it. So fashion has more price elasticity. It's more of a luxury than is gasoline. So to make things more aggravating for us as we think about these things, as we try to set prices as poor marketers do, the price elasticity of demand is not fixed. It moves too, making us a little crazy. So how does that work for us? Well, let's take a look at our pizza example one more time. So the decrease between $10 and $9 produces an increase in the total revenue. And so at this point, the demand is elastic. We had a little drop in our price. We had a nice increase in our sales. That looks pretty good. But let's move along this curve. Out here, when we drop our price from 6 to 5, or from 5 to 4, or from 6 to 5, we actually have a decrease in our sales. Our total revenue goes from 18 million to 17.5. So now we're in the domain of inelastic demand. Holy mackerel. So these are things that marketers need to think about as they think about pricing their product. Step 3, given all this background, determine the relationships between cost, volume, and, after all, why are we in business mostly for profit? Marketing, determination and satisfaction of consumers' needs, wants, and desires at a profit. So let's think about profit here. To talk about this, we have to think about total cost, fixed cost, variable cost, univariable cost, marginal cost, and marginal analysis. Details to follow. How many of you guys have seen Shark Tank? One of the important key things they ask on Shark Tank, where the contestants often fail, is on the question of their costs. You and I are sitting here, you're going, well, of course we know our costs. We're business people, don't we? Not necessarily. So, 8 questions you need to answer perfectly before you're going on Shark Tank from Business Insider. What are your costs? Investors want to gauge your ability to make high profit margins by keeping your costs low, or by having enough demand to keep prices high, or ideally both. You should be able to explain what it costs you to make each product or service, and the difference between the cost and the unit sales price. You should also be prepared to outline overhead costs, such as rent, utility, expenses, and insurances. And of course, the reason this is listed on this 8 questions, not all presenters know this information. Knowing your costs and volume and profit is important in the class, but in the real world. All right, total costs. Total cost is the total expense incurred by you in producing and marketing, thank you, a product. So the total cost is the sum of the fixed costs and the variable costs. So TC is equal to FC plus VC. Basic accounting, we all know this from accounting. Yeah. So fixed cost is the sum of the expenses of the firm that are stable and don't change with the quantity of a product that is produced and sold within reasonable bounds. Within reasonable bounds. I mean, if you go from making 100,000 of something to 2 million of something, you may need a whole new building, a whole new production line. That's not what we're talking about. But within reasonable bounds, these things don't change based on the quantity of the product that is sold and produced. So, I don't know if it's in your notes, in which case you can yell it out, or if we just, if we know. What are some things that don't change based on how many of things we make? Except in my example, right, the building cost. So we're making 100, 200, 500, it's all in the same building. It's a fixed cost. Other sorts of things? Say again? No, labor would change depending on how much I make, right? So if you're making 100 of these things, and it takes you an hour each, I'm paying you $5 an hour, I'm paying you $500. If we're making 200 for labor, suddenly I'm paying you $1,000. The labor does fluctuate based on how many we make. Shipping costs would fluctuate. If I'm shipping, making and shipping more, they're going to go up in total anyhow. So, the salaries for executives. My salary pretty much stays the same, whether we're making a little or a lot. Taxes. Now, you must be an accountant. Are you in accounting?
No.
Oh, all right. So taxes. I would have to say they're probably variable because the more I make and manufacture, the higher my revenue is, and so those taxes will go up. And if it drops back down, my taxes go down, so probably variable. Rent on your building or the building itself. Insurance, by and large. Again, you can find examples where it does change. So these are things that are fixed costs. So whether you're making a little or a lot, these costs have to be covered to some extent. Something's got to pay for them. On the other hand, so these don't change as we sell more products, again, within bounded domains, within reasonable domains. Now, variable cost is the sum of the expenses of the firm that vary directly with the quantity of a product that's produced and sold. So for example, labor. The more you make, the more you get, bless you, the more you make, the more you got to pay your workers, yeah? In general. The materials that are needed to make the product. I won't ask you to yell out. I'll just ask you to think back, because we actually, in passing on marketing or business, the news talked about the most expensive part of a EV, of a Tesla. Okay. Go ahead and yell it out. You're right. Let's look at this cost.
Take a look at any Tesla Model 3 and try to guess what's the most expensive part to manufacture. Go ahead. We'll wait. It's okay if it's not obvious, because you can't see it without tearing a Tesla apart. Investment bankers UBS ran an analysis of such a teardown and found that the battery makes up to 40% of the manufacturing costs of any Model 3. The battery has been one of Tesla's greatest challenges in their goal to make a vehicle that's affordable to most people, yet still profitable. The ticket price for a Model 3 is currently about $42,900, while the average new car in America is selling at around $32,000. In February, Mr. Musk tweeted that the Model 3 is down to just below $35,000, but only if you include $8,000 in gas savings and a tax credit that's set to expire on July 1st. The $42,900 ticket still puts the Model 3 outside of reach for most consumers.
Certainly the first or second most expensive thing in any of these vehicles is the battery pack. And so they are acutely interested in shaving off every penny they can from the cost of that pack, because obviously the vehicle market's very competitive and they are competing with internal combustion engine cars.
Analyst Sandy Munro, who tore down Model 3s, touted its battery management system, saying that Tesla is far ahead of the competition. Model 3 batteries comes in at $111 per kilowatt hour. That's 20% cheaper than the nearest competitor. But so far, it hasn't been enough to hit the $35,000 mark without tax credits. So the company has looked for other ways to optimize battery costs, like scaling production. In 2015, the automaker announced a joint venture gigafactory with Panasonic.
Corollary is that if you centralize a huge amount of production of one thing in one location, your supply chain is simplified, your logistics are simplified, your manpower distribution is simplified. There's a lot of other like overhead or exogenous things that can be, you know, significant in the overall like rundown of why does this cost what it costs.
So for now, Tesla will have to find some other way to get to a true price that has wide appeal in the States. Tax credits or production line tweaks can help, but without a scientific breakthrough, there are limited ways to make big savings in the battery. For consumers, that means another generation of research is due before EVs can really compete on price with their gasoline-fueled alternatives.
So we need to be aware of our material costs. What does it take to physically make the product? Sales commission, part of your marketing costs. The more units your salespeople sell, the more you got to pay them if they're on commission. And of course, including that, you could consider advertising costs going up as part of what's going on as well. Unit variable cost is the variable cost expressed on a per unit basis. So the unit variable cost is equal to the variable cost divided by the quantity manufactured, or UVC is equal to VC divided by Q. Marginal cost is the change in total cost that results from producing and marketing one additional unit of a product. Again, something we got to know as we think about how much we're going to make of these things. So marginal cost is equal to the change in total cost divided by one unit increase in quantity, is equal to the change in total cost divided by the change in Q. is equal to the slope of the total cost curve, recalling your joyous days in micro. Module analysis is a continuing concise trade-off of incremental costs against incremental revenues. So let's see. I don't think we revealed this previously in talking about other things. How many of you guys know Beats by Dre headphones? Anybody have them? Yeah? Do you remember what you might have paid for them? They were a gift. You don't know. So my kid, who works in high finance in New York City in a bullpen area with a bunch of other people, I was going to get him a gift, and he wanted some headphones, because you work in that crowded area, you have headphones. All the guys have headphones. And he wanted Beats. I looked up stuff. I'd done a little research. Turns out Beats aren't the best product. They're plastic. There's better sound out there. Bose, for example, has better sound. But all the cool kids in the floor had Beats by Dre. How much are Beats? And how much do they cost to make is the question on the floor. Let's check this out as of the time we put this together.
DG can swindle $1,000 from an intern, but she still can't convince him to...
We're back with Rover's Morning Glory.
What were you just asking, Doozy, about something about Beats by Dre?
Yeah.
What is that?
It came out what the real cost. I was fascinated by what something really cost.
To make?
Right, and okay. Then what they charge.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, you want the...
Give me the info. These Beats by Dre headphones, first of all, they really don't sound that great, to be honest with you.
Everybody has them. You go to the gym, you walk past a bus stop, everybody has these things on.
Yeah, they really don't sound that great. And they sell for like $300, right?
The cheapest ones you can get are $200, but they go up to $700.
$200 to $700.
Why $700? What's the difference? What could you do?
I think they have like Lil Wayne wears them. Lil Wayne. I think there's like little crystals or diamonds on them or whatever. I just seen some really fancy ones.
Ooh. Now, how much do they cost to manufacture, Dieter?
You want to guess?
Ooh. $200 to $700.
Yeah, and they sold the company for what?
$1 billion or something, right? Or $2 billion or...
I think $3.2 billion.
$3.2 billion, okay. To Apple. Apple bought it. How much do the Beats by Dre headphones cost to manufacture?
Oh, for $300 to $700, I don't know what your gift cost. How much do they cost to manufacture? Wild guess, there's no reason you would know. How much? $25? $35? $68? $15? All right, who thinks it's, what was your number? How many think it's higher than 68 if they're selling it for $200 to $300? How many people think it's lower than 15? Oh, boy, you guys are cynics. Let's see what the right answer is. World of business.
$65.
No, get the hell out of here. No way. Not that high. No way. Not a chance. They're plastic, douche. They're plastic.
I would say they 65?
Yeah.
I would say they cost... Now, one thing that people don't consider, though, when you might see the cost, oh, this is what it costs to make, and look how much they charge. Well, what about all of the management, the marketing,
thank you,
insurance, or God knows what else, legal
fees.
That of course no. That's not included in there. So that's going to bump up your actual cost per unit. But the manufacturing cost, what it costs to make these things, is probably in the range of $10 to $12.
No, I'll go down to 50. I'll give you $50. If it's 200, so that's $150 profit per one.
Jeffrey wants to pipe.
I'm going
to
put my guess at $20 for them to manufacture.
Mm-hmm. All right. Go ahead. Give me the rundown. What does it cost to manufacture Beats by Dre headphones?
So Rover was the closest. They sell for $200 to $700, like I said, but the actual cost to make, $14.
$14?
Yeah. So look at that markup.
Oh, that's incredible, isn't it?
That's why they're making so much green.
Wow. Again, you do have to put the marketing. You think it's cheap to get LeBron James or someone to be in a commercial and to produce that commercial and to buy the airtime for that? Those don't factor into the cost. So your cost per unit may jump up to $50 or something for all we know. But the actual cost to make these things is $14.
$14.
Wow.
So even Rover says, wow. So that's why I say it's the cost to manufacture and market, thank you, Rover, the product is what you have to keep in mind. So that's, whoops, where was I? I guess that's as far as I got. So in order to try and understand this stuff, an easy way, I put that in quotes for us to do, is to do a break-even analysis. It's a technique that analyzes the relationship between the total revenue and the total costs to determine profitability at various levels of output and tells us where do we not make or lose any money. What is our break-even point? Again, a fairly important thing for marketers to think about and know about. So a break-even point, quantity at which total revenue and total costs are equal in units, is your total fixed costs, my salary, the building, divided by the unit price you're getting for each unit that you sell, minus the unit variable cost. So you can see here it's FC, fixed cost, divided by P, price, minus UVC, minus unit variable cost. So here is a picture frame store. We're going to do a break-even point for. For example, my wife likes to go to Mary Kay Bricker for her framing. So if we sell zero pictures, you might imagine that no matter what our price is, our total revenue is zero, unit cost is zero, variable cost is zero. Fixed cost, though, even if we're selling nothing, the salary and the building, whatever, have a cost. There's $32,000 in cost, even though you're selling nothing. So your profit at that point is minus $32,000. Hopefully you don't stay there very long. So let's wander along here. Let's look at our fixed costs. They don't change whether we're doing zero or 2,000. They're $32,000. Fine. Our price per picture frame in our example doesn't change. It's $120 no matter how many we're selling. We've retained a steady price per picture frame. Our unit variable cost, how much it costs us to manufacture and market each one of those picture frames, $40 for each one. So we can use this arithmetic to work out our break-even point, $32,000, our fixed cost, divided by our price, $120, minus our unit variable cost, $40, gives us our break-even point of 400 units. So at 400 units, we're breaking even. We're paying for our variable cost plus our fixed cost, and everything after that begins to contribute to the rest of our needs. We sometimes show this in terms of a chart that makes it useful for the visual learners. So let's look at this. What would this straight, flat, black line with the triangles be? What number would that be? Straight black line doesn't move. Oh, are you gesturing because I went too fast? Do I need to back up? So there? Is that where you need to be? We're good? Okay. If you don't stop me, I don't know, I have to stop. All right. So what's this flat black line with the triangles going to be? What is that, would you guess? Say again? Not no profit, but thanks for the guess. I appreciate that. What's the flat black line given what we just talked about? Fixed cost. Boom. Our fixed costs are what? $32,000. Zero, $400, $32,000. Then our variable costs start at that $32,000 that we have to cover. And now they start building up and up and up over time. So our fixed cost plus our variable cost goes up as we manufacture more and more stuff. Total revenue from our chart, it's zero when we sell zero, and it grows as we move up and along. Here is the break-even point that we just talked about. At 400 units, which we just calculated on the previous slide or two, we are nothing. We're at zero based on our arithmetic. So to the left of this little portion I'm pointing to the left, what is that situation for our business? To the left of the break-even point? Say again. Thank you. To the left of the break-even point, we ain't making no money. We're losing money. A little bit just below it, a lot all the way to the left of it. And this should not be the hardest question of the day. To the right of the break-even point, what's it mean for our business? Thank you. Profit. All the way up there to that sweet high mark in our example. So if we sell 1,000 frames, yay us, what's our situation? Well, our fixed costs don't change no matter how many we produce along a reasonable boundary. So our fixed costs are still $32,000. Our variable costs, cost us $40 per unit to make times 1,000, $40,000. Our total costs, therefore, are $72,000. Our revenue at $120 each is $120,000. But a bink, but a boom. Our profit, $120,000 minus $72,000, or $48,000 in profit at 1,000 units. Be nice for us to know that if we're in business. Okay, so this is the basics of understanding, beginning to set our price. There, this is from, same thing from the book. So we've set the foundation for price, but of course nothing's that simple. So we're going to work on that foundation and manage our price a little more effectively. So lecture notes, maybe, I keep thinking I slipped the lecture notes page, but around 202. So the six steps, we've talked about identifying pricing objectives and constraints, estimating demand and revenue, determining cost, volume, and profit relationships. We just covered all that. Now we're going to go on with the next three steps. We're going to select an approximate price level. We're going to set the list or quoted price. And then we're going to spend time making special adjustments to the list or quoted price. This is an example I like because it shows the interesting impact of the market situation, where you could set your prices at. And it goes, where's anybody here today from construction management? Yeah, okay, this is one of those few examples that relates sort of directly to the area of construction management. The example goes back to a situation where our construction management site is using pile drivers, pile driving equipment. You know what that is? I mean, either from your background or from your class, a pile driver. Most people won't know what that is necessarily, so I'm going to come up and play with you for a minute, if you don't mind. So what is a pile driver, and when would I want one? Do you know? Why would I want to drive poles into the ground? Electrical poles, for example, or if I'm building a building on sort of a sandy soil that there's not a lot of rock foundation, I'm going to drive these steel poles into the ground till they get something solid so I have a good solid foundation for my building. Okay. So in the old days, we had these pile drivers. As a construction site person, I probably don't own my own pile driver. I rent it. It's probably not cheap. I got to rent it. I got to rent the operator. They probably have to tow. It costs me money per hour to have that pile driver at my site. When I was driving piles in the old days, that pile driver, which is a big metal boom, down on another piece of metal, they would put asbestos padding in between the pile and the Post. Before they realized that asbestos is killing people, that was what they did. So those pads were not that expensive to use, but on a per unit basis. But imagine the cost if you have to change those pads out 20, 30, 50, 100 times, and that pile driver is sitting there doing nothing while you're pulling the pad thing back out, unloading the old pads, putting the new pads back in, bringing the equipment back. It could cost a lot of money to be changing those pads. Construction site managers weren't thinking that way about it, but okay, it was. So somebody came up with a cushion pad, a new technology. The thing was patented, it was wrapped up, and you could use this new pad hundreds of times more than the original pads. How do you price this new product to a construction site manager? And if you could convince him how much he was really saving between not changing out all those cheap asbestos pads and not having to back that truck up, you could be saving him thousands and thousands of dollars over the course of a job. Try selling them on that. So the most you can charge for a product is the value that they perceive your product to have. That's the absolute maximum. So in this little case example, the actual question was, what you imagine you could convince the construction manager this thing would be worth. It probably isn't the true absolute value. The minimum you can cost, of course, is you can pay. The minimum you can charge, of course, is how much it costs you to make the thing. So the minimum is the variable cost. The maximum is the value to the customer. In your world, then, what's the real range you can go for? How much can you sell a pair of plastic $15 headphones for in your world if you hook Dr. Dre's name to it, if you hook my name to it? There's a difference. So this is the idea of the range you can go for. And within this, we're going to think about some different approaches with this as background to how we might set our price, our initial price. And one set of approaches are called demand oriented pricing approaches. And the first of these we'll think of is an opportunity, given your product, given your customer, given your market situation, of price skimming. Price skimming is an approach where we set the highest initial price that customers who really, really, really want the product are willing to pay. My fallback example, flat screen TVs, when they first came out, 20 grand. And people were willing to pay that, knowing full well the price was going to drop over time. So marketers charged that. We're able to do price skimming when we have a newer innovative product. We see it early in the product life cycle when those innovators are really ready to jump on this new thing. So in price skimming, we set our price high relative to our costs. My black downward to the pointing right curve here is no longer a demand curve, it's now your cost curve. And what it's indicating is something we talked about before. And they've mentioned it elsewhere in battery production. When you have long, long runs of a single product due to economies of scale, the learning curve, inventory, shipping, all that, the unit cost per item manufactured goes down and down and down. And if it doesn't, you've got to fire your entire manufacturing staff. So that's what's happening here. Over time, that price per unit is dropping down. Price skimming, we set our price high relative to our costs. And we note that our costs will go down over time with longer production runs and more experience. So we get significant profits. And in fact, if we choose, we can begin to drop our price down over time, but retain high profits because our unit cost drops. Flat screen TVs, 20 grand, 17 grand, 13 grand, 8 grand, 6 grand, 3 grand, $500. Early producers could price skim. So we would love to use this in the real world because, first of all, it's going to help us to rapidly recover our development costs. Think back to that product life cycle curve we looked at. While we're developing the product, how much revenue are we generating? while we're developing the product. Negative, it's costing us money. We aren't selling anything, we're developing it. Wouldn't it be nice to get that money back? So why does this work? Well, first of all, customers really want that product. You are selling to a set of innovators. They really are interested in this new product. Also, because it's a brand new product, there are no competitors yet. You know full well, I've told you before, as soon as you're successful in a business, competitors are going to rear their ugly heads. And obviously, you have to have some production protection on the product, copyright, patent, or it's a unique process, or it's just really hard to make. As a result, there are no easy substitutes for the product, no competitors. So we have an inelastic demand curve. High prices, still lots of sales. So we can recover those development costs. And by the way, if that early price is perceived as too high in the marketplace, we can lower it down. Go to market with a new product, price it at some point, and then later on say, it's the same product, but I'm raising prices on that product. Customers don't like that. Your channel distribution doesn't like that. Go in too high, and you say, oh, we're going to lower the price because we like you. Okay, we're good. The original iPhone was released June 29, 2007, at $599 for the 8-gigabyte model. By September of 2007, Apple dropped the price to $399. Why? Initial sales were lower than they expected. Who really likes that price drop, would you say, in this example? True example. Who liked the price drop? Yeah, but who? Who liked them? All consumers? Consumers who were about to buy it, who probably didn't like this price drop. Consumers who just bought it for $599. What do you mean it's $399? Apple's no fool at marketing. They offered those consumers some special coupons for, you know, products or whatever, cents of percent off. So, an example where price gimming was too high, they were able to drop it down and smart enough to go back and help out those who paid $200 more. What's the disadvantage here? The major disadvantage is you are making buku bucks, lots of money. So you are going to attract competition. And clearly, Apple attracted a lot of competition in the smartphone market. A totally opposite approach, given your situation, given your market, given your product, given your consumers, is penetration pricing. Penetration pricing, as your initial strategy, involves setting your price very low on that new product. What are we trying to do here? We want to appeal as quickly as possible to everybody, to the mass market, not just the innovators. So it's a low price. Our goal then, if it works as planned, we should be able to capture for this new product a whole bunch of people, a large market share. Because it's such a deal, such a value. So when would we use this? Well, first of all, we'd use it when we're the first one out, but there are not big barriers to competition. We can't copyright it. There's no patents. It's not that hard to make. We want to get in and get as many people buying from us as we can. Also, because we're not making a bunch of money on each one of these things we're selling, we hope that the product life cycle is pretty long. We expect it to be a long product life cycle. And when we expect the demand to be elastic. Why? Well, since we're lowering our price relative to what it could be, we certainly want to see a lot more demand than we otherwise would have. Otherwise, you're lowering your price and you aren't making more sales. That's stupid. Have a higher price. So, an extended, nice long product life cycle with elastic demand. So here are for the visual learners. Here we have our cost curve going down. We set the price low compared to our cost curve. It creates a little bit of a margin. And as we produce more, our costs go down. We keep dropping our price down. So it's a little profit margin, but we make a lot of money over time because it's a long product life cycle. This teeny margin is likely to discourage competition. They look at it and say, man, I can't produce that cheaply. He's got a big jump on me on costs. He's not making a lot of money. It's not worth it to me. And because we get a large share of the market quickly, if all goes well, our volume is larger and our production cost per unit drop more quickly than can the competition. We already got most of the market and we're selling a lot to them. How are you getting in at these costs? And with luck, with high volume, we'll still get enough profit for our company, not on each unit, but overall, we're selling a lot of these things. Now, it's a bit of a risky strategy. You got to be able to do a good job of forecasting your demand because you've got to ramp up your production fast as that mass marketing takes off. You have to be ready for production and ready for distribution. And then you're stuck if demand does not develop as you expect it to, if it doesn't develop, then your production costs stay high and you don't make a profit given your price point. So it does require a little planning. Slide down the demand curve involves starting with a price skimming approach and then reducing prices as our costs decline. It's done to appeal to a wide market once the premium price buyers are satisfied, flat screen TVs, or to react to an influx of competitors. They see that we're successful, they're coming in. We're gonna slide down towards our cost. Looks a little like that. Begin with a high price relative to our costs. We get a good profit initially, nicely done, and then we slide by plan down very close to our cost curve. And again, if we're first out there, our cost curve should be less than others, so we're looking pretty good. This allows us to recover our development costs early on because we're price skimming. Discourages competition because we're dropping our price as our costs go down, and our costs should be lower than those people coming in later on. If all goes well, they aren't going to be able to get in with a reasonable price. Again, this assumes a reasonably long product life cycle. Disadvantages, hard to know just when to begin dropping prices. If you drop it too soon, you're giving up profits you could otherwise had. If you drop it too late, competition can sneak in under your umbrella, under your price point, and then there you have a new competition to deal with. I have more exciting price examples to talk about, but we're out of time. This will be the end of the material for Mini Test 11. Midterm 2 is open. Research Extra Credit 1 is open. Other Extra Credit is open. You got a lot to do this week. Don't forget about it.